Hi folks, how you doing? I hope this finds you well. I hope you've had a little moment over the bank holiday, or maybe you're in a part of the world where it's not bank holiday. Here in the UK it is. It's been lovely actually. But it doesn't stop us, that's all I'm going to say. Oh no, no bank holiday any time of the year stops us from delivering you another episode of Soundtracking, and it is our absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us. Loads of great stuff coming up. I think I said on the last episode that I am going to be hosting an in-conversation with Tom Cruise as part of his season at the BFI. He's receiving the BFI Fellowship. And the night before that, I'm kind of slightly giddy that I've been asked to host a Q&A with him. So I have an hour of one-on-one with Tom Cruise this time next week, next Sunday night. So I have so enjoyed diving into all his back catalogue of film, kind of outside the Mission world. Very excited about the next and final instalment of Mission, but digging into things like Risky Business and A Few Good Men, Magnolia, Vanilla Sky, Last Samurai, so many other, Rain Man, it's just been joyful. So if you get the chance to get along to the BFI to watch one of those films on the big screen, I would highly recommend it. Magnolia being a particular favourite of mine. But anyway, let's get on to this episode, shall we? And I'm so happy that it's a Thunderbolt special. It's the latest episode of the podcast and we are chatting all things Thunderbolts. As first director Jake Schreier and then composer Son Lux join us to discuss the music of the latest installment of the MCU franchise. Thunderbolts tells the story of, I guess, an unconventional team of Marvel anti-heroes. Yelena Belova, Bucky Barnes, Red Guardian, Ghost, Taskmaster, and John Walker. And they embark on a dangerous mission that forces them to confront the darkest corners of their past while, of course, attempting to save the world in the process. Now, I went along to see this at the premiere, actually, with Rudy, my oldest, and the audible excitement from the audience, which included us, was palpable and infectious. I don't feel like there's been this kind of excitement for a Marvel film for a while. I think that there are a lot of things that have helped that. Florence Pugh being a massive thing about it, just in terms of that character, Yelena, that we've kind of fallen in love with and kind of captivated by in the number of things that she's appeared in. Black Widow, or whether her very short but memorable appearance in Hawkeye. This is a really different Marvel film. And you know when we've had those moments along the way of the Marvel Universe where directors have come in and allowed the film and the cast and the story to tell things a slightly different way. Taika being a really great example of that. Guardians of the Galaxy, another great example. I think that Jake has done an extraordinary job on this one and really kind of set the bar in terms of how relatable all these characters can be and the themes that run through this, depression, mental health being a huge, huge part of it. And it's really accessible. The performances are astounding. So I think that it's once again kind of shifted Marvel into a really interesting kind of direction and arena, really. So I'm so excited about where it goes next. Now, we're going to hear from Son Lux after Jake. But let's begin with their first cue from the movie, There's Something Wrong With Me. Thank you. Listen, congratulations. I was in that room last night and I haven't been in a room with that energy, both before the film and after, in a long time. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was just so fun to show it to an audience, you know, because I've been sitting there watching the movie like by myself for 15 times, I think, in the last week, because you got to QC the P3 version and then the Dolby EDR version and the IMAX version and the IMAX 3D version and the thing. And then you just sit there watching and you're like, I hope anyone connects with any of this. And it was nice to be in a room where people did.
When do you know when it stop? Like when is...
You don't. It's just pencils down at some point. It literally... Because you could keep, you know, we have such incredible effects artists on this movie and you could keep refining them forever. But at some point... The due date comes up and you turn it in and that's that.
It's creeping towards you. Can we go back to the start in terms of, I loved when you said last night that Kevin had sort of said, do something different. So what was that kind of jumping off point for you in terms of what you jumped into and what you wanted to tell and do differently?
Yeah, I think John Watts was my roommate in college. So I've been around some of these movies and I did second unit on the LA portion of the first Spider-Man. So I knew these guys and I knew the movies. And I think like, coming in, I had a certain understanding and expectation and knowing from John that like they really do want you to push story and like make it, you know, like they never really stop trying to improve it. Like that's kind of Kevin's ethos. So I was aware of that, but I don't know that I was expecting how much he really wanted us to push it. And that was such a nice kind of nudge to be given by the head of a studio that has been so successful doing what they do. I think it was just, is there a kind of character that we could bring into this world and a story about that character that you haven't really seen before? And when you have Florence Pugh and you know, just starting right there, I mean, you're just so lucky to have that. You could really do anything. I mean, she really can do anything. And so it was like, wow, if you have that, like, is there a story we could tell that dovetails with like how talented she is? And I think it started to feel like if it is about these kind of cast-offs or people that thought they were destined for one thing and it didn't work out, like what is an internal story that could go with that? And, you know, when Sunny came in and did drafts and then Joanna eventually after, who had both worked on season one of Beef, like we really kind of started to hone in on that. Some of those similar ideas in Beef about connecting with the void, you know, like given that the void is a character in the actual film, and like what would, knowing that character is so powerful, like, what would connect them? That was sort of how we looked at it. It's like, what's a story that we all go through that, you know, I think we're also, you know, something that Sunny has always kind of advocated for, both in Beef and this, is that the idea that stories about depression are not niche stories, you know, anymore, that like everyone at this point is more cognizant of going through that and that it isn't, as strained as it might seem to make a summer blockbuster about a character who's depressed and going through it, that's broad now. Like, that's a mainstream idea.
Absolutely. And it's the breadth of the tone of the film as well that I just think is extraordinary. You know, you have kind of proper belly laugh out moments. You have kind of those action moments. Then you have those incredibly emotional moments, you know, like Florence and David under the kind of bridge moment, which is genuinely kind of, you know, tears streaming down my face sort of thing, because the way these characters have been presented to us, we care about them. They feel like they're, you know, could be our neighbours, could be our friends, could be our family sort of thing. I think that's the wonderful way these characters have been written and presented to us as well. And I can't imagine how that's written, but you have this cast who just bring it to life as well. So beautifully.
Yeah. That was another scene that Sunny wrote pretty much whole cloth. Yeah, I mean, when you have Florence and David, and that humour comes from actors and character, you know, when actors take a character seriously.
Yeah.
And David, obviously, he provides a lot of comedy in the film. That comedy comes from character. Like David's not being broad at all. You watch that scene and it's some of the most kind of nuanced, reserved, beautiful piece of acting that an actor can do. His character is big. You know what I mean? Like he's a character who wants more than he's been given and wants to be this kind of outsized hero. And so that character of Red Guardian kind of allowed us to be a little bit more meta within the world because the character himself is invested in the idea of superheroes and who Captain America is and how he would measure up. And so it allowed us to go in there, but we as a movie really don't step outside of where these characters are. Like we don't break the fourth wall or comment on it. Like it all really like stays with them. And, you know, each of these actors showed up every single day. They take this very seriously. Mm-hmm. And I think you probably can really only get to that kind of comedy, like that character comedy, when when they are grounded in that. And I mean, with these, I just felt so lucky every day with them.
It's so great. Even that scene where it's Ghost, Florence and Captain America, and they're kind of going, what about the hat? You know, and all those kind of, it's just.
That's
it's,
full improv, by the way. That is,
no.
We did two takes. I think I knew that Wyatt was like sort of frustrated with the helmet from Falcon and Winter Soldier. He's talked about that openly. And so I thought it would be funny to prompt Florence to bug him about it, but that's entirely them. And really just, I think we did that whole scene in an hour and a half on a day. We had four other scenes just in the back. We did two takes. We let them go for about 5 minutes each take, and then that's all done.
Yeah. Did you do a lot of that in moments?
Not a lot, but that felt like a moment. And especially like that was a little deeper into the shoot, and they all knew their characters so well at that point. And it felt like, let them go. Like they know what we're going for here. So,
as well as that kind of range of kind of tone and emotion that we go through, the music's got to kind of be on the journey with that, you know, be a character almost through that for those different relationships, emotions, situations and stuff as well. And Sonlux have done an extraordinary job on that.
Such special musicians. Yeah, it was interesting to kind of, what was so nice about our process on this is that, you know, a lot of movies, quite often what you'll do is you'll go into the edit and you'll get temp music and then you fall in love with the temp music, and then at some point you're basically just asking your composer to copy the temp music. And so a lot of what we're listening to in movies is like a copy of a copy of a copy.
Yeah.
They were so gracious enough to, like, we made so much of this music during the shoot, and they would just send me piece after piece after piece, and it stems for all those pieces. So by the time we got into editorial, we maybe had 40 sketches, and all of them stemmed out so that Alex Levy, our wonderful music editor, like, we could cut that to picture. So we're temping with their music that they could then iterate on and build more of. And obviously, you're supposed to have character themes. It's hard in a movie with this many characters. And so it was interesting that it became more about finding, like, a void theme or a commonality of, like, when characters are going through a certain mood, like, what is the music that scores that? And through it being, like, the same theme, how does that connect them? You know, and that was something that I thought was so nice about what they did. So it became more about, like, themes for the Thunderbolts, like themes for Val, and then themes for this kind of underneath feeling that they have that connects all of the characters in the film. And we approached it more from that perspective.
You know, I only saw the film last night, so I kind of have not had that luxury of kind of making notes on things as well. But there was a couple of really poignant moments as well that really sort of stood out in terms of just absolutely breathtaking, stunning, small moments of music in the film that really kind of highlighted the kind of depth of the shared experience, I think, with people going through some of those themes.
Yeah, well, they did such a beautiful job on Everything Everywhere All at Once. And, you know, that's the thing. Like, Kevin's a huge fan of that film. And, again, as part of that edict to make it different, it's like, who could we bring into the world that would see it fresh, you know, and take a new tack at the way that they approach something? And then also, because I know Ryan and those guys, and just they're so technically skilled as well, and so much of their music is orchestral. Mm. And so when it needs to be a big Marvel movie, like, they can do that too. And it was so fun to get to watch them play with those tools and get there. So again, we always talked about the movie as it starts very different, but by the end, you should feel like it lives up to the kind of legacy of these great movies that Marvel has made. It just got there from a different route. Mm. And so it was a lot about, like, there will be brass eventually and there will be big themes, but, like, we've got to really hold it back. You know, like we've got to really, really like let it out piece by piece until you get to the end or those big moments when Bucky arrives and the music really gives it to you. And then you feel it all the more because it hasn't been doing that in the way that you might have expected to before then.
Yeah.
And they did such a nice job of kind of doling that out.
Moment last night in the theater when Bucky, that was great.
That's fun. That's fun.
All those moments were so, that doesn't happen very often, particularly in the UK. We're quite reserved.
Oh, okay.
In terms
good
of
to
how
know.
We.
Actually,
oh my
sure,
God, are you kidding? I mean, that's a unique experience. I remember being in the States a couple of opening weekends and going, this is brilliant. Everybody just lets go. That was such a audible response to the film last night. I mean, there's so many moments as well, laughs, cheers. Gasps as well, sort of thing.
The gasp was my favorite. I don't know if we can talk about the gasp.
Yeah, no,
but
let's
but
not.
That
yeah.
One. Yeah,
I almost did a no moment as well, for sure.
Yeah.
How involved does Kevin get in the music? Because, you know, across the captain of the ship, across this huge vessel, I've never had the chance to talk to him about it yet, but music feels important to him.
Oh, yeah.
In all these different kind of journeys that the world of Marvel's taken us on.
He's a really brilliant editor. I mean, you know, like, obviously he's got a lot of projects he's working on and he's not there, like, every moment of the edit. But when he would come in, yeah, he had some really, really intelligent, and it was kind of music editing notes where it's, like, moments of surprise. Like, I think I hadn't quite processed, like, we had built the music up to these moments and he was like, oh, you can't quite do that. You have to have the beat happen on the offbeat of the music or not where it should land, and that'll give you more of the audience surprise. And you could just see the difference in the test screenings. Like these moments that we've been trying to get to land and we're close, all of a sudden we got the gasps. You know, we got those things we were looking for. So yeah, like he cares deeply about music for sure. But I don't know what the perception is out there. I mean, he's just very open about things, you know, like, and he really likes filmmakers and is really excited when people bring things that feel new. It felt that way to me the whole time. And then when there is something to work with, then he gets engaged and loves to get in there and get into the edit. And there are a lot of really smart, like, little tweaks within scenes or ways to focus in on a different character that he brought to it. It was really fun.
What about that conversation about needle drops? You know, that's another thing across the Marvel world is, like, there are some films where it works, some films where it doesn't, some films where there's a little kind of soupçon of a needle drop in there sort of thing. What was the conversation about what you wanted with Thunderbolts in terms of, you know, pre-existing music?
Obviously, there are movies that this could get compared to, and, you know, like, everyone knows Suicide Squad or Guardians, you know, and it just felt like James did that so well, you know what I mean, and he kind of owns that corner, and it felt like, in a way, to distinguish ourselves, you know, it'd be nicer to take a different tack, and I think partly because we're going for this kind of different, more internal thing, it felt like really working with Sunlux and giving ourselves the real estate with their music to help guide you towards that would be sort of more valuable.
They're almost a bit like their own little collection of musical superheroes in a way, because the three of them have together, they're this wonderful creative kind of explosion, and individually they each bring something slightly different to the table on that as well. And I love that about them in terms of having talked to them in the past for everything. It was like, you know, it's like, oh, this is my strength, this is my strength. But together it's this kind of wonderful kind of synergy in a way.
Yeah, yeah. You could kind of try to pick it out. It's like, oh, is this Rafiq? Is this Ian? Is this? But, you know, in a way I was like, didn't want to know. Because like when it really is the best is when they've all touched it in some way, you know, and it's like it really, when it has that, you know, when it brings that percussive nature and like Rafiq's melodies versus the way Ryan scores things and like together, it really does become something special.
And they've got that kind of almost bookend as well, I guess, in a way, which is something they've got to navigate. You've got that opening sequence, you know, and do they get given that to work with, or how does that work? And then also what I love about the Marvel films and those end scenes, will there be, won't there be, will there be one, will there be two, is it makes you sit and stay. And the music on those closing credits is just so beautiful and something that everybody should enjoy. And that was another thing I loved about last night. It almost gives you a moment as well as a fan to kind of just kind of take everything in.
Well, and we found we needed that because there's such a left turn at the end of the film that we, you know, we worked, Imaginary Forces did that great credit sequence with us. And it was kind of about, and this was another thing Kevin weighed in on, where it's like, we need to give them room. It's like the music is almost bringing you along to a form of processing and acceptance of what has just been thrown at you. But what's so cool about that is that they made, just to even get the job, they made a suite of music, you know what I mean? Like for the film, and it was so beautiful, and Kevin and Lou loved it so much. And like I would just listen to it the whole shoot, and I played it at the table read, you know what I mean? It was this nice thing of like, for the actors to get to hear Julia, I would send her pieces of music the whole shoot. Lewis, like when we were going to some of his most emotional scenes, I would have all of these sketches that we're going to form the texture of this movie. And they're in the film. You know what I mean? Some of those actual recordings are in the film that you could kind of give to the actors and feel like this was all being made at one time, like as a piece along with it. And that ending music, it's been adjusted a little bit since, but like if I played you that suite, it builds up to that moment. Like that. And so to finally be editing that and have had it in your head the whole time and shoot it and then have it land in the actual film. Again, I just think it's such a more exciting way of working with music and film is to start, like when a musician makes music, I was in a band, you know, like you don't take a song and just copy it. That's not like a way that you make music. And so to make film music in that way just feels like it kind of puts a cap on how inventive it could be. But like real great music starts from its own kind of inspiration but you have to have composers like Sun Lux that are willing to put that time in and do it ahead of time and really put that effort in before, because you might not use it. It may not line up when you actually put it together. But we found when we got into post, in fact, the only pieces of music that worked with the movie were those sketches that they had made ahead of time. It's a hard tone to find.
That's amazing.
They had a script, but but a lot of it was just, you know, I'd go over to Ryan's. We live pretty close to each other in LA, and we'd kind of meet up, and they'd play things, and I'd be like, I think that feels like it's right. And then they would go off, and they had scripts, and then also we would send them, you know, we had storyboarded sequences and animatics and things like that, and we would send that so they could kind of score to like a version of picture.
But we have got there is, from my memory from being in it last night, one needle drop.
I guess technically there's two.
Oh, okay.
But you're basically right. Yes, okay. One.
Starship?
One in the... Oh, well, there's Pony, though.
Okay, right. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Pony, I would say, is like the true, or unless you count, I mean, it's diegetic.
Okay. Yeah.
So I don't know if that counts as a needle drop.
I don't know the rules.
I don't know the rules either. That's, we got two. We'll
okay.
say two.
I'm just a bachelor. I'm looking for a partner. Someone who knows how to ride without even falling off. Gotta be kind of slow. Takes me to my limits. Talk to me about them.
It actually, that was a John idea, John Watts, you know, when he helped so much on this film, like just checking in with him and having a friend who's gone through it, you know, and been so successful so many times in this world. He was like, oh, you could do this thing in the limo sequence, like that'd be pretty fun. So like the song coming on, and then it was just, I mean, I do love the song Pony. So it was just finding whatever would be, I think we also tried Exile, Kiss You All Over.
Okay.
It was like, so we had that and we had Pony, and I think we just landed on Pony in the end. Like, we kind of ran them both, and that seemed to get the best reaction. And then Starship, I mean, that was from the trailers. I mean, obviously, I love the song, and I love Bill Hader's dance and Skeleton Twins, and, you know. But it just felt like, again, like Alexi gives you that rope to be a bit more meta, you know. Yeah. Like, so it felt like, I mean, that's such a dyed-in-the-wool credit song that might feel a little, you know, like, you guys are reaching for this, but coming off of that Alexi beat at the end, it just feels like you kind of, it fits with him and the way he would like to see the team. And then again, once you sink into it, you're like, well, I do love this song. So it's like a nice way to sit through the credits. Yeah.
How does it work with the end scenes? You know, when you're coming into this film, Kevin, sit you down and go, okay, we need two. Or, I mean, how does it work?
No, it's quite open. It's very, you know, you kind of know going in that, like, you know, these days there's often two. In this case, we didn't film either of them in principal photography. Like we were, I mean, it's a Marvel movie. We had a lot of resources. I'm very grateful for them. But we did, coming off the strike and, like, you know, some of the shutdown costs, like we did have to keep things responsible and tight, wrapped on time. Actually, a day early, I think.
Well done.
Photography. and so we thought, like, well, in the end, we'll probably know more what we want these to be later. And so we'll film these as part of when we go to do a little bit of additional photography. So the Alexi one came from that. The other one, I don't know if this is, if I can say this, I didn't direct that one.
Okay.
That one comes from the set of a movie that is currently.
You're already passing the baton.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was something we talked about, is like, how can we.
Yeah.
And it felt, I got to be there for it, but it came from the set of another film that is currently being filmed.
It's another thing we love about the world. Absolutely, completely. Yep. It's so great. The locations are extraordinary in this as well, you know, in terms of the reality. You know, we feel like we're in the real world. Is there a location for you whilst making this that you were kind of like, I don't know, whether it was, I can't believe I'm filming here, or this has just worked so perfectly, or how the hell are we going to make this work? And it has, that really stands out for you.
I mean, it'd be two. I think when we went to Utah, that was when it really felt like the shoot opened up for me. You know, we had been in Atlanta. And we tried to take that approach in both ways. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's built on stage, but Grace, our wonderful production designer, we talked about, like, sure, maybe in a strange way it feels smaller, but we built massive sets. And it was like, how can we scale the sets to a size that we can build all of, so what's behind their heads is real, as opposed to, like, sure, you can have a bigger room, but it's not real, and then you lose touch with that reality. So we tried to keep it, when we were in Atlanta, like, mostly builds, things that you would have built anyway. Like, there is no underground vault, so that was going to be a build.
Yeah.
We would go out on location for, like, things that you could build, but it felt like if Nolan were making this movie, he'd find a floor that you could use, like, an abandoned floor of a building. We don't need to build that floor of Avengers Tower so that you're in a real space and there's stuff out the windows that maybe we augment, but it has a bit more of that texture. And then going to Utah, I mean, that's where you're like, okay, this is special to have the resources. You know, you could use those resources to do, you know, giant space sequences, or you could take it to go out to the middle of Utah where most people don't get to shoot. It's not as big of a tax credit, and really be in a place that almost no one shot before.
Yeah.
You know, like, own an entire road in the middle of nowhere. and do these stunts for real out on that road and do the car scene. There's no green screen in that. I mean, they're just driving on that road in 100 degree heat, even just for the dialogue out there. And there's a texture of that that comes into the film. We had a real helicopter airlift that box out of there, like up on that hill.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Not CG. The helicopter, so it feels more like Val,
yeah,
gets replaced, but the box itself is being lifted off and you're tracking to a real helicopter that goes in. And then, yeah, when you're on the roof of the second tallest building in the world in Malaysia, it feels like, okay, we're somewhere now. This is something, yeah.
And she fought for that, didn't she?
It would not have happened had Florence not.
I,
we talked
Florence.
In the beginning. Yeah, only
back
Florence.
Back to what we were talking about.
Well, but I just want to say that you know, I think, look, obviously the stunt is very impressive. But I think when you watch it in the movie, I mean, that shot starts as a close-up on her face, yeah, when she's going through a real emotional moment. And to know that you have an actress that you need real acting, and then the camera's going to pull out, and within that same take, they have to do one of the scariest things you can possibly do. And I never for a second doubted that she would do it, because when she's in character, she'll do anything. She's so committed to acting and so fearless. I mean, when I asked in the beginning, I was like, how are you with heights? And she was like, I love heights. What are we doing? You know, so she was appropriately scared like anyone would be on that ledge. But I do think that, like, in a weird way, it's more of an acting stunt than it is an action stunt. It's about watching an actress like that be in character for a moment like that and do it all as part of one, so you really follow along with what that character is going to. That to me is more impressive than the simple act of doing it, which is also short. It's quite crazy, but I think that's what strikes me.
It's the, when we see her from the side, when the step off and the confidence and the silhouette almost, it's just like, you just hold your breath.
Yeah.
There's only one Florence Pugh and there will only ever be. She is just a...
I'm a very lucky guy.
Yeah, and there's a really lovely tie-through with the Hacks and Cloak, obviously, who did the music for Midsummer, who worked with Yon Beef as well. That's a nice little Florence connection,
isn't it?
It's a
great
little
community of people. Yeah, Bobby's great.
Just quickly before we finish, congratulations on Beef. I mean,
thanks.
What an astonishing show. Again, performance so important to the kind of, to the way that we connect with it, I think, as well. But music on that as well, very important. So you're very different on an episodic nature as well, which is a different beast in itself.
Yeah. I mean, Sunny also cares so much about music and is so involved in that and creating a texture. And it's interesting because we found so much of this movie is Sunny's voice as well. And so, like, it has that tonal shift. Like you said, there's all these different tones where it is very funny. You know, Sunny wrote on Two Broke Girls and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but also obviously is quite brilliant and has this artistic perspective. Finding music that can bridge all of that is not easy. You know what I mean? And it takes these great composers like Bobby, like Sunlux, to wrap all of those things into a package that fits together. So, yeah, we're working on season 2 right now with Beef. So
amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting. Oh, wow. Can't wait for that.
Yeah.
Thank you for this.
Thank you.
And thank you for kind of telling their stories and feeling like you're telling kind of a bit of everybody's story as well in this film.
If it felt that way, then that makes us very,
great,
very happy. So.
Lovely to chat to you. Thanks so much,
Jake.
Yeah,
thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
The score to Thunderbolt says Every Man for Himself by Sunlux, which leads us nicely on to the second half of this soundtrack and special, as Ryan, Rafiq and Ian join me to dive deep into their magnificent score. And here's another one of their cues, First Fight.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Great.
Great. Thanks.
Congratulations on an absolutely extraordinary experience. I haven't had an experience like that in cinema for such a long time. It was just wild. It was so great.
Thank you.
I had the pleasure of chatting to Jake the other day, so it's nice to kind of get the icing on the cake with getting to chat to you guys. And he was just full of praise and appreciation and just enthusing about the collaboration with you guys. And what I was so kind of intrigued by was the fact that you guys wrote so much music before, you know, they'd kind of really started shooting, to be honest, which, you know, in turn really informed so much of the film in a way. What was it? What were you guys reacting to? What was the kind of conversation to dive into, to starting to write music and themes and suites for the film?
You know, we started blank slate, no expectations. We came at this project from a place of just kind of willful ignorance about how exactly we would do this. We really had to trust Jake, you know, like we had to, he had a lot of trust in us that we were the right pick and got the studio on board, and we felt welcomed to the process right away. That gave us, I think, the kind of ease to explore. Like, you know, we were coming off of the heels of Everything Everywhere All at Once, which was a project that was amazing in a number of ways. And one of the ways it was great is that we really were, you know, welcome to be ourselves. And now here we were doing a Marvel movie. So, I mean, the precedent is huge. You know, it's the 36th film in the MCU. And so will we have that same kind of welcoming, you know, the question at the outset was, will we be able to find ourselves in this? And thankfully, I can say that we did. We just like in Everything Everywhere, we found new versions of ourselves to explore. But yeah, the process just started completely blank slate and well before anything was shot.
Did you have that? Because I, you know, one of the film has got this kind of really emotional weight to it, you know, and it's so many things. You know, one minute has you kind of belly laughing, the next minute you're kind of like, you know, you kind of feel like you've got your hand in your heart almost at one point. And there's these fantastic, you know, I've only seen the film once, so I can't be as specific as I'd like to be with you about specific cues and things. But what I do remember is there being this vast array of diversity of the music, from kind of really small, powerful, intimate moments to kind of, you know, what you kind of expect from a Marvel film, those kind of big, grand, bombastic moments as well, and everything in between. I don't know how you start with something like that, you know, in terms of, do you start big and pull it back to small, or is it small and big, or is it both ways, really?
Well, that's really like, you know, it's astute the way that you ask the question, because if big is sort of the standard, you know, there's a ceiling for music, right? Like you can only get so big. And so if you can figure out how small you can go, then you have a lot more headroom and a lot more contrast so that the big moments can really feel big. Mm-hmm. And the small moments by contrast can feel really small, and they can both kind of, each can feel more like itself in light of the other. And I think we, you know, that's another area in which we really have to give it up to Jake for very early in the process, kind of instilling in us this idea that, like, you know what, this music, like this movie, needs to be grounded and it needs to feel human and vulnerable, because these characters, you know, they're complicated and they're, you know, small in certain ways, and there are going to be where it needs to get really big. But like, can we find the small, the intimate, the close, the vulnerable in this movie, and then expand outward from there?
Reacting to script, I'm putting my hands up and saying Florence Pugh stole the show in the previous film with Yelena. You know, it's kind of like the presence is extraordinary. So you have a sort of flicker of what that character's capabilities are on screen, but the depth that that character's going to within the context of this film is extraordinary. So were you reacting to script and then, you know, taking that as your interpretation of the story?
Since we were brought on so early on, we were reacting to the script as well as just direction from Jake. You know, that early version of the script that we read was really fantastic, and it had all of these elements in it already. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, after it was actually shot and the performances that the cast gave are amazing. And like you said, Florence absolutely killed it. Like it took on obviously like whole new dimension and depth, but yeah, we were reacting to the writing. And the nice thing about being able to pre-score as much as we did, I'm actually curious, like how many tracks or like how many, like we
I know
we made so much music before the movie.
I don't think we ever did like do an inventory of like things unused versus.
I mean, every week we were probably delivering anywhere between like 3 to 12 pieces of music.
Yeah.
Wow.
For a while to Jake just to vet. And the way the process went was very much like the first thing that we had to figure out was themes. So we kind of were just sending him theme after like so many themes. And he was the one who was really kind of astute and had the vision in his brain to be like, these are the four. These are sort of generally the purposes that they'll serve. That's the seed from which everything will grow from. And it was really beautiful that we were able to kind of establish the sound of the film even before they shot, because, and maybe Jake told you this in your chat with him, but like, you know, we created a suite sort of all the main themes early on to show the executives and things like that. But also Jake played it for the actors for their first table read. And I think that's so cool to like have.
What a gift.
Yeah. I feel lucky that we're not. I feel like the job of a composer can often feel like you're catching up in the traditional kind of way that it's done, where you're part of post-production and you're given an edit that's like got a bunch of temp music already in it. And you're just trying to like catch up to like where the actors are and catch up to like where like the edit's at and everything. And obviously also dealing with like trying to navigate, how closely do I follow the temp versus not, and all this stuff. And like the first cut we got of this film was all our music, because we did that work ahead of time.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
a lot of extra work, but like,
yeah,
but it means that when there is something to look at,
you're
spending your energy on refinement and not
because
the discovery process is essentially done.
There is this thing with temp where like, you know, what ends up happening is where like in that particular moment and that scene, that piece of music, the scene often is like literally cut around it and everyone's seen it a million times. And like, you know, what ends up happening is that like, yes, maybe that piece of music actually is the best or most perfect hand in glove fit for that scene. And you'll never get there with a bespoke piece of music that wasn't integral to it in the same way. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, when those pieces of music that are in different scenes don't have the coherence altogether that a score needs to have, then you're really fighting an uphill battle, because there's no way you can ever do as well for the particular moment while also creating that general big picture thing that a great score needs to.
And then you have those moments that are kind of those sort of one-offs in the film as well. So like the Bucky arrival scene sort of thing as well. Do you know what I mean? And that's kind of like the noise in the cinema when that happened was just, it was gorgeous. They must be kind of fun moments to kind of, you know, sort of to kind of play with in a way, you know, in terms of both in terms of how. And it was really interesting talking to Jake about how involved Kevin Feige is and how brilliantly collaborative he is, and what Jake learned from him with regards to editing and with the music and stuff in terms of the beats and where the beats hits and all that kind of thing as well, which is just really fascinating.
Yeah.
And that's a great example, I think, of that sort of thing, you know, of kind of everything just kind of has to kind of hit kind of right. And then it's almost like a tidal wave hits the audience in a way.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, you know, we are chasing, you know, maximum impact for an idea. And kudos to Jake for always really keeping a really strong understanding of the goal from moment to moment. we get so granular, like we, you know, and in our little corner of the universe of movie making, right? And so we naturally see everything through the lens of the score. We have to trust our director to keep a different lens, keep different glasses on. And when there is, could, because there's so many different ways to score any given scene.
Totally.
And it's really so satisfying to look back on a film. And this was the same with Everything Everywhere. We just really got lucky in both cases to look back on a film and be like, yeah, the director was right. That works great. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, because I'm sure there's a lot of composers out there who look back and be like, ah, I wish I got my way or whatever, you know?
But I feel
like in general, we were super in sync on things out of the gate. And then when we were in places where it's like we were maybe like misfiring a couple times, like trying different ways to in on the scene, in the end, like Jake led us. I mean, he didn't just direct the actors, you know, he directed us.
Yeah.
Job, and like it's awesome to look back and be like, oh yeah, like that's totally what it needed. That example was one of them, because we had done a bunch of different moments for Bucky reveal, like, or just called, we called it Bucky reveal, I don't know what
yeah
but
it kind of doesn't spoil anything then when you say, because you know we see him from the start, so it's kind of like it doesn't give too much away.
And what also is a really interesting tidbit to know is that the core musical idea of that moment is actually something that I had written in advance of beginning this project. The first time Jake was in my studio, I played him a bit of something that was just something I had made, like, you know, totally different instrumentation, totally different sounds, whatever. I actually accidentally pressed play on the file, because it wasn't something in my mind that was like going to be applicable as a reference for maybe where he headed. And he goes, wait, go back to that. And I played it, and he's like, that sounds like Thunderbolts. And I was like, oh, really? And again, and because I was too granular, I was thinking sounds, I was thinking instrumentation, I was thinking all these things that he wasn't thinking. He had a bigger picture lens of even the musical idea. And over time, what wound up iterating in the film sounds so different, probably to everyone else's ears, but to his. He was the director, and he could hear it, and he could sense it, and he could sense. And so it's really fun to like know that like that was a musical moment that stood out to you, because its origin was the intuition to recognize that it was right from a director who obviously knew what he was doing, even when I, the composer in that case, didn't, you know.
Levitate towards when you are starting to write? Do you have instruments, or, you know, or what is it that you kind of sit and kind of feed into? Is it instruments? Is it digital? Is it a combination? Is it different for every project?
We're all pretty in the box. Like, we're not, you know, you go to our studios and there's not like a wall of synths and stuff like that. It's a lot of custom instrument design. Often a starting point for us is sound. Although for this project, I would say a big part of the starting point was melody, like theme, things like that. But we are very sort of like propelled by sounds that we are excited by. And so I think a lot of the times the way we work is by like designing these instruments, usually out of sort of recorded audio material that we have from somewhere, and finding
creative ways to iterate it and creative ways to make it like a playable instrument. And for me, like a lot of the times it'll be at a keyboard, you know, at a MIDI keyboard, experimenting with these sounds. And there's, you know, there's different parts of the process. Like early on as well, one thing that I did was I was trying to think about like what could be the identity in some ways for the percussion of the film. And because Jake kind of from the get-go told us like he really wanted to try to make the sound of the movie smaller than a typical superhero movie, you know, I was trying to think of ways to meet that brief with percussion, because, you know, one of the ways in which a sound becomes huge is when you like add orchestral big bass drums and like huge crashes and stuff. And I was like, well, what's like a way we can have percussion that's propulsive and stuff like that, but it's very kind of tactile and small and not bombastic. And so one thing that I ended up doing was I work in a studio that's like part of a larger studio, and they had like some like gear getting shipped in, and this tape machine was being delivered on these like wooden pallets.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing after it was delivered, the wooden pallets were just sitting by the door ready to go to the trash. And I just knocked on it and I was like, these things sound pretty great. And pulled them into my studio and recorded a bunch of ideas on them. And that
wow.
One of like the main sounds of the percussion in this film. And that's one thing that's important to understand about us as a band, is we're not compartmentalized to our instruments that you see us put on stage.
Yeah.
Like we're all drummers, we're all like harmonic and melodic thinkers and things. And so I did the wood stuff. And then Ryan at some point also pulled in a bunch of kitchen items from his home, and like did a lot of sampling, just like playing the kitchen pots and pans and
amazing
concrete and things like this. And yeah, I mean, there are moments where there's big kind of orchestral percussion, but the majority of it is culled from these sort of ingredients.
Mm-hmm. That's extraordinary. Any kind of, you know, because obviously the Thunderbolts is part of the Marvel world, and there's a kind of musical framework there around that. There's so many different scores and so many incredible composers who have worked across that. But there's an element of kind of not expectation, but there are, you know, with those opening credits and things like that. So is that something that you had to, I don't know, that you had a conversation about in terms of, or was it just never really kind of come into to the creative process or the collaboration?
Well, I think there was from the outset this sort of, I mean, for us, like one of the first things that we felt when we were asked about this was like a little bit of like confusion and pinching ourselves, because we were like, wait, really? Us? Like, you want us to score a Marvel movie? It was just such a, like, we were like, whoa, cool, but also like, really? You know? And like, you know, as you said, like, it's just such a massive, like, not only musically, but just as a body of interconnected sort of stories. Like, it's such a massive thing, and there's so much, you know, if you start to think about it that way, you can quickly spiral into sort of like,
yeah, totally,
what do we even do, you know? And I think thankfully one of the main sort of thrusts when we were originally asked about this was like, it was clear that there was a desire both on Jake's part and on the studio's part to like approach this a little differently and like have some new energy in the mix, you know? And and so we felt like there was some confidence, and that we were being approached to really be who we were in the situation and bring ourselves fully to the situation. And you know, Ryan's existing working relationship, having worked on another project with Jake before this, like, it all helped give us this trust to like really be like, okay, you know what, this is you know, such a vast universe, but we're going to find our little corner of it with this movie.
Yeah. What you've done is so brilliant. And also, I've got to mention the end credits as well, because I think that's one of the, as much as I love the extra scenes, one of the things I love about the extra scenes is that it makes people sit down and listen to the music that's on the end credits. And it also kind of, you just appreciate how many people are involved in a film like this as well.
Yeah.
I could just listen to that all day. That's just amazing, that journey that you go on from, you know, the last scene over the kind of end credits and those two extra scenes. So I think it's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's kind of a cool story about the first part of the credits, which is that we had this little like gap of time where Jake was like completely tied up on other things. And we were headed into our first scoring sessions at Abbey Road with London Contemporary Orchestra, ideal orchestra to work with in the world.
Amazing.
Amazing, right? And iconic place, incredible storied place, but also like the engineering there and everything is just, the people there are amazing at Abbey Road. And the purpose of this initial session, the primary purpose of this initial session, and I believe this is something, as far as we know, that is unique to this project for Marvel, was this. We wanted to treat the orchestra the way we treat really everything else when we're making records. And the way we make records is we often go into the studio very early and we record raw ideas that sometimes we even originate on the spot. So we show up together, just bring presence and create music together from scratch, often in the context of live mics and improvisation. Sometimes we'll have prompts, like little musical prompts or little challenges that we're all nerds. We like to like just have like little theories to explore. Now, imagine if we could do that with orchestra. And so that was our pitch to Marvel. And happy to say that they went there with us. And so this first session, first group of sessions at Abbey Road, we had just raw materials. We had nothing scored to picture. We just had these sketches that we knew were working well in the edit, but also just like raw materials, just like some basic fundamental thematic DNA. But we also kind of needed just a little more like through composed music. And so back to the credits topic, I wrote this section of music, just kind of stream of consciousness really quick, just to get out the door to the orchestra. And I sort of imagined that it would be cool for like an end credit sequence, but it was a little bit risky to do that, because you know you're recording, clock's ticking, money's getting burnt, and it was awesome that in the end, like the way it worked to open the credits was like super great, and ultimately propelled that initial sequence of credits. It's an example of risk taking that I think that we were able to accomplish on this film that we're really proud of, but it's only because we had the support of the whole community, of people making this movie.
Yeah, and it really was a community endeavor, and there is a level of exchange that I hope is like audible, you know, like it's one of those things where like you don't know how something's going to be perceived, but you, when you make it, you're so it always will be connected to how it came to life, you know, and working.
You feel it.
You feel that. And it's working with those players in the London Contemporary Orchestra and those great orchestrators and, you know, Hugh as orchestrator conductor, like, and his team, even in this early session, like it was like, okay, like, are they going to go there with us? This is such a structured situation. It's so, you know, it's so different than like the intimacy that we can usually get to with players right away. And so we're like, okay, like, here's this arpeggio. Now play it only as air noise. Now can you play it like you're really drunk and like it sounds contaminated and bad? Will you go there with us? Okay, now like, oh, wow, really cool idea, Hugh. Like you can point your baton at the orchestra and while they're playing it, anyone who gets pointed at freezes on the note that they're on until we have just like a cluster, you know? And so we were doing all these things together in real time. We'd hear them, hear it down, and then, you know, one of us would chime in with the next prompt and we were just, you know, moving through them. And that material ends up in so many transformed, you know, like, because then that becomes the source material and then we're manipulating it, like Ryan said, the way that we would any other piece of audio. In certain ways, it's presented in the score in like completely unrecognizable, like you would think it was a synth or some sort of weird noise type, you know, derived thing, but it actually is the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And in other sense, you know, like in other situations, it sounds exactly like it did, you know, in the room. And that continuum between thoroughly processed beyond recognition and thoroughly like live and exactly how it was and everything in between that was something that we were so excited to try to explore in this project. And we're so grateful that we got the chance to do it. Cause I think if you really look for where that line is in the score, it's hard to find.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see the film again. I also can't wait to just get the luxury of listening to the soundtrack as well, just as its own thing as well. Yeah. Huge congratulations. It's so great to chat to you guys again. And I very much look forward to what's next as well. And if only to be a fly on the wall in one of those sessions as well.
I know.
For sure.
Right? From the score to Thunderbolts, that's Left the Door Unlocked, bringing us to a close of this double episode of Soundtracking. My huge thanks to Jake, Ryan, Rafiq and Ian for taking the time to talk to me and all the team behind the scenes to facilitate in our time with all of them. Really, really appreciate it. Thunderbolts is on general release now, and as you've probably gathered, it is a film I'd highly, highly recommend seeing in the cinema. We've spoken to loads of actors, directors and composers involved in the MCU before, but there is one in particular that I'm desperate to get a chance to talk to. Do you know who that is? Kevin Feige. But if you want to hear any of those previous episodes with any of those people as part of that world, then head to edithbowman.com and use the search facility to dig out all of those. You can follow us on our socials. We're at Soundtracking UK, and please subscribe to our YouTube channel, Soundtracking Extra, for loads of video content. Now, what I love about Soundtracking, one of the many things I love about it, is when we get the chance to speak to new directors early on in their career. And what I love even more is getting the chance to catch up with them a little bit further down the line to talk about that journey, see where they are, what they're doing, and really enthuse about those new projects that they're working on. Our next guest, writer-director Shannon Murphy, is a great example of that. Baby Teeth was the film that we originally spoke to her about, and since then, she's worked on Dope Girls, but more recently, Dying for Sex. You might have heard about this.
phenomenal show. I can't wait to share my conversation with you, chatting to Shannon about many things. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.